Hello and welcome to Running Dialogue, a podcast about movies. My name is Kurt Holman, and I'm a staff writer with Creative Loafing Atlanta. And here again with me are...
My name is Matt Goldberg. I'm the managing editor for Collider.com.
And I'm Russ Fisher. I'm an editor at SlashFilm.com.
Yeah. And today we're going to release the Kraken on Clash of the Titans and speak maybe a little bit more flatteringly about How to Train Your Dragon. We just saw Clash of the Titans last night, and we all have very, I think, similar feelings and opinions and attitudes about that movie, and none of them are very good. So we could probably rip on Clash of the Titans for the entire discussion, but we want to maybe leave some room for some more positive things to say, and we'll bring in How to Train Your Dragon for that. So
it's a good idea.
Yeah. So who wants to sum up this remake of the 1981 Ray Harryhausen film?
I'll take a stab.
Okay, you go.
First of all, Clash of the Titans opens with the assumption that we don't know who the Greek gods are. And the original movie kind of did that too, but as laden with expository dialogue as the original version is, this one is even sillier. So basically you've got the Olympic gods, the gods of Olympus, Zeus, Poseidon, Hades being the brother of those two who's in the underworld, and kind of made out to be an analog for Satan, which isn't really what he was in the Greek myths, but that's indicative of the tweaking that's been done with these characters in general, which is to say a lot. Yeah. But anyway, so people don't dig the gods anymore. We're not really told why, and the gods are sort of bummed about this because their power is contingent upon prayer and devotion, etc. So
all of which is kind of stated but not explained or shown in any clear way.
Yeah, we don't get any real sense of like why the people have stopped believing in the gods, or if in fact they have, or it's kind of like jumping into the middle of a revolutionary movie where the revolution is already in progress. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense, but again, that's also representative of the whole movie. So you've got basically, the film pretty quickly picks up with Perseus, who is turns out to be a half-human, half-god, a demigod, who's the son of Zeus. And essentially, Zeus and Hades come up with a plan to release the Kraken, which is a water-based titan, and they're going to use the Kraken to destroy a city, and in doing so, get people to respect and pray to the gods again. Perseus kind of comes into the picture and decides that he's going to stop the Kraken,
partly because he wants revenge on Hades for indirectly killing his family,
exactly,
and partly, you know, kind of as an act of defiance against the gods.
Exactly.
Period, because you know,
because everybody's angry at the gods and they're angry. That's all we get.
Yeah. And this is where the film makes no sense. If I can just jump.
Oh yeah,
in.
Please do.
Because Perseus's quest is to find a way to stop the Kraken,
right?
Because Zeus will release the Kraken.
Yeah.
However, Perseus is also Zeus's son. Mm-hmm. So along the way, Zeus helps Perseus. He gives him the special sword, gives him special tips, tries to protect him.
Yeah.
By protecting him in his quest to stop the Kraken that Zeus could just stop on his own.
It's like on one level, you could probably find similar inconsistencies in actual Greek myths of gods helping characters in ways that might not seem to be round. They might not come around to their best interests, but it doesn't make a lot of sense here.
Right.
One thing I want to say about the premise of this, of the movie, which is a little bit different than the original movie, is this idea of humans in rebellion against the gods, which is a pretty interesting idea, you know, because it's they're real and they're the gods, you know. I mean, they're going like, it's like, you know, people don't know. It's like, we're going to tear down Zeus's statue, and we're going to make fun of the gods to their faces, practically. And what are they going to do? And, well, they're going to come and smite their ass,
exactly.
Basically. You know,
yeah,
so it's like, why would they do that in the first place?
Atheism may not be for you.
Yeah.
And there was a point early on in the movie when I wondered, okay, is this going to be kind of an interesting analog for the rebuilding of faith in our time? It's no.
Yeah.
No, it isn't. Because none of that is explained. Again, we don't know why the people don't like the gods. You get the sense that it's meant to be because there has been a lot of smiting done in the recent past, and people are sick of being smitten.
Smote.
Thank you. Definitely not smitten. So, but that's never explained, and there's no, you know, there's, like I said, the original movie kind of overladen with expository dialogue, but some of it is necessary because you kind of got to get an idea of what's going on. And this movie tries to, well, this movie is directed by the same – by Louis Leterrier, the same guy who directed The Hulk with Ed Norton.
The Incredible
Hulk. The Incredible Hulk, I'm sorry. And that movie sort of jumped into being an action movie really quick, and it's very propulsive. And you get the sense that he tried to do the same thing with this movie. Like, okay, let's get all this stuff set up so that we can just get to the part where Perseus and Mads Mikkelsen fight giant scorpions. Mm-hmm. Okay, fine. But in doing so, we don't get any introduction to characters. There are all these people in the movie who we barely know, consequently don't care about. You can barely differentiate some of them. I mean, there's this point early on where you know, Zeus is basically Zeus fathers Perseus by way of a mortal couple who rules city-state. The guy in that equation gets kind of pissed off. He casts his wife and the newborn Perseus out, throws them into the sea in a box from which they are retrieved by a fisherman played by Pete Postlewaite. Whose name I can never properly pronounce, and I'm just going to run with that.
Pete Dinglehoffer.
Exactly.
Postlethwaite.
Yeah. Is that what it is?
Postlethwaite?
Okay. So, and so Pete, the fisherman, pulls this box out of the sea, opens it up, sees the crappiest mermaid ever, half woman, half baby. This sucks. And then apparently kind of takes Perseus's mom as his wife, but it's not really explained. It's kind of – I get the sense that maybe it's the same person, maybe not. We don't really know. There's a lot of stuff that's just kind of glossed over. You get the sense that there are a lot of scenes that are cut out, that are trimmed. And
it's very confusing and choppy like that, and in ways that seem like they're just making it unclear.
Right.
Well, one of the things – and I think one of the – biggest problems is that because it's trying to move so fast, you can sort of do that with the Incredible Hulk because it's a single protagonist.
Right.
It's Bruce Banner trying to escape. Government wants him. That's simple as that.
Yeah, I mean, that movie is like the Bourne Identity with a Hulk.
Exactly.
You know?
And I think it's a good movie. The problem here is this is a quest film that focuses on a group. You have a group of characters. And I didn't know their names until it, like, I barely knew who they were.
Right.
Basically, they're in a lot of the movie, and basically, I'm like, okay, there's young guy, and then there's Mads Mikkelsen, is sort of the gruff but wise, you know,
he's so
guy who should be the
gods.
Yeah. There's like the wacky hunters who are like a Pirates of the Caribbean.
Yeah, torn straight out of Pirates of the Caribbean. Absolutely.
Cynical old military guy.
Yeah.
Orlando Bloom resembling.
Yeah, not
guy.
Orlando Bloom.
And then you have, and then out of nowhere. You have Io, played by Gemma Arterton, and she is just a weird character because we were discussing this before we started, but I think it's important. I didn't notice this looking at the film, but the way she's cut in is very awkward. She doesn't seem like she's part of the group, and it seemed like this is completed, but we need more of a female presence.
Yeah. She's kind of explained as being like Perseus in the sense that she's kind of a demigod. She's not human. She's not a god. But you don't get the sense that she is a demigod. She's something else.
She helps Perseus, but doesn't really fight that much.
Yeah.
As an actress, I kind of liked her more than most of the cast.
I mean, I like her. Yeah. She's very attractive, and in a lot of scenes, she's just around to look pretty. And from a story perspective, I was saying earlier, she's kind of like the Bond company stooge in the Wes Anderson movie, The Life Aquatic. You know, she's sort of there to make sure that things keep happening and keep going, and that the whole thing doesn't break down. But beyond that, if you can just sit over there and look good, that would be great.
Well, that's actually – I'm sorry. I don't mean to
– Well, one thing, I mean, this, we could probably, you know, unfold that, but one thing about the original movie is that, you know, it's not a great movie, you know. It's got monsters that are fun and cool that we like, and it's got, it's cheesy in a way that's pretty appealing, and like, even like the stupid mechanical owl looks kind of charming almost.
And when it makes when it makes a cameo in this movie, it's just stupid.
Yeah. Well, it's not only stupid, they're like, oh, that's silly. And then I'm watching the rest of the film, it's like, you could use Bubo.
Yeah.
You could use that owl, because you guys kind
of
suck.
And this movie is almost, I thought it had like the cheese of the first film, but none of the charm of it, you know.
Well, the interesting thing about the first film, there are two things that I do like about the first movie, as cheesy and slow and clunky and sort of bad as it is when you look at it objectively. First off, it's an interesting two-part story. Mm-hmm. Essentially, you've got Perseus, who is abandoned to the sea in the same way that he is in this film. He grows up sort of raised by this hermit, or no, he 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 grows up and then he's transported to an acquaintanceship with this hermit and basically falls in love with the daughter of Cassiopeia. The first half of that movie is a love story where he's kind of going on a quest to sort of gain the hand of this princess.
And kind of find his own
Calibos and right. sort of him discovering who he is.
Exactly.
Although when he washes up on shore, it's with his mother, and his mother is alive.
Right,
that's very clear.
But anyway, it's the first half of it is sort of this quest love story, and then the second half turns into this quest to defeat the Kraken because upon the completion of that quest love story, the mother of the woman that he's in love with compares her too favorably to a goddess who gets mad and then sets loose the whole Kraken thing. And so he's got to go on another quest to defeat the Kraken. And it's like, okay, that's kind of a neat structure. It's ambitious and it's a bit more like the original mythologies in the sense that it's kind of episodic, but has these characters running through it and it really works. Whereas in this movie, the story is just kind of a very creaky, cobbled together chase scene.
Yeah. And the conflict with Perseus, he has to go up against Calibos, but whereas sort of Zeus is in Perseus's corner, you have Maggie Smith, I forget what god she plays, but she's in Calibos's corner.
Right.
And so
she's his mother.
She's his mother. And so there's a conflict there that makes sense.
Right.
And it's not just sort of Zeus being ambivalent about what to do. They're just sort of pawns in the godly game.
And in the remake, the bad guy, Calibos, who looks kind of like a devil, is basically Hades' sort of mortal advanced man, and Hades gives him power so he can go after them. But Hades is like all over the movie anyway, so it's like, well, why does he need this mortal when he's acting and doing all this stuff anyway? You know?
And then it turns out that Calibos is actually a different character from the story who's mentioned early on, and he's been transformed into Calibos. Yeah. And it's kind of like, huh? Why did you do that?
Yeah, it's like if you haven't seen the first movie, it's probably really confusing.
Maybe anyway. The other thing about the first film that I liked, which is sort of pointed to by what Matt was just saying, is that the thing about the Greek gods and in their original conception in the stories is that they're like really powerful people. They're analogs for people. They're capricious. They're petty. There's a lot of infighting. There are all these weird, incestual relationships between them. There's a lot of that stuff going on. And the original Clash of the Titans, again, kind of represented that pretty well. You know, they're kind of these interesting characters, and then the way that they're sort of talking crap about each other behind one another's backs, there's a lot of infighting. And in this movie, you barely see most of the gods. You don't get any of that indication that they have any personality whatsoever. And it's just sort of like...
And their makeup and costumes look pretty terrible.
So oh, God, yeah.
I think the costumes look all right for the people, but the makeup, for the most part, is wretched.
The makeup is wretched. The hairstyle... I mean, there's a lot of hairstyles that look like they came right out of Battlefield Earth. Mm-hmm.
It's like Hades looks like John Travolta in Battlefield Earth. Somebody say, this might not be what we're going for
Right.
Although I wanted to say about the Greek gods, the best way I've heard them described, and again, the 1981 version gets closer to this, is I had a professor in college, and he said, imagine if you could do anything. All right, so what did you do the first day? And he's like, after a little while, that gets boring. And so the gods can do anything. And so that's like they're capricious. They don't care. And in a weird way, they live vicariously through mortals.
Absolutely.
Because mortals have stakes, but gods, there's nothing that can happen to them.
Which is why in both movies, key mortals are represented in the home of the gods by this wall of action figures.
Yeah.
Zeus has got this sort of, uber geek collection of little clay people that, and they can take them down and play with them. And that's exactly what it is. It's like, people are kind of like, it's like, oh, let's play Risk tonight.
Yeah.
But we'll do it with people.
Right. And in the that comes back in the remake, except now instead of being clay, they're pewter, and I guess in a better casing. Like, seriously, yeah. Of all the weird things, it's weird what this film chooses to bring back.
Well, it's different. The difference is that, you know, in the 80s, people actually played with toys. And now yeah. they just buy them and put them on the walls. Yeah. So they have to be shinier. Right. And in that case, okay, yeah, this movie is more representative. Yeah.
But, you know, I was, like, doing my review earlier, and, like, kind of the only things that I could say that I liked about the movies were the way the scorpions looked and moved and the way the Kraken looked and moved. And yeah. there was not a lot else, really. Maybe Gemma Arterton, who played Io, you know.
Yeah, she's fine. I mean,
I think Ralph Fiennes has an interesting performance. I mean, at least it didn't seem so grandiose, because I think that's a big problem with the film, is it sort of falls underneath its own weight. Mm-hmm. Everything is so serious. And I don't mind that earnestness, but it seemed like every chance the director, Louis Leterrier, got to make a choice, he said, go bigger. Mm-hmm. And that's not really good directing, because that's very simplistic.
Right.
So, for instance, there's this one zealot character who's
like the Baptist type.
Right, in Argos. He's like, we got to do this. And, like, he's so over the top and obnoxious. You're just like, okay, we don't need any more of this guy.
It's like he's borrowed from a Roland Emmerich movie.
Yeah,
you know, he could fit really well in 2012 or in, you know, whatever the 10,000 BC or what. You know, any of those movies.
It says a lot about Roland Emmerich that you could say that, like, a movie set in 2012 and 10,000 BC are interchangeable.
Have the same, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, I couldn't stand Ralph Fiennes in this. I thought he just looked kind of embarrassed, and I was kind of almost upset because I've seen him be so good so recently, like in Bruges and as Voldemort and The Constant Gardener and The Reader, because I really like The Reader, and it's sort of like it sort of blew his little streak to me.
It's not a good performance, but he does. I'll agree with Matt in the sense that he does make Hades this kind of, you know, a specific character and very recognizable, and one that goes just beyond the makeup. And he's not recycling his Voldemort. He's not recycling his character from In Bruges. Mm-hmm. You know, he's got a couple of very iconic sort of villain portrayals, and he doesn't just go back to that. He tried to do something different with it, and I can respect that. Whereas, say, Liam Neeson does just look embarrassed. Mm-hmm. And I mean, there's scenes early in the movie that take place in Olympus, and they're just miserable. Mm-hmm. They're terrible. They have the gods standing on these weird little podiums over this kind of giant Google Earth
wrist. Yeah. And over their little wrist mat.
Exactly, yeah. And it's just weird. And most of them, I mean, there's some actual actors playing these other gods. Danny Houston plays Poseidon. I don't think he even gets a line. Mm-hmm. He stands there
it's clear
with eyeliner and a pitchfork.
Something's been cut out with him.
You know, you get the sense that a lot of stuff was cut out, and whether because the stuff that was cut was worse than what's in the movie, which means it's pretty freaking bad, or that, again, they were just going for this propulsive all-action narrative. Mm-hmm. It's hard to say, but regardless, you get the sense that there are a lot of things missing, and that carries throughout the entire movie, where there are just these kind of bizarre gaps that, you know, make no sense if you're actually trying to pay attention to what's going on.
Right. And things like just one more point about the monsters. It's like, you know, one of the best maybe the best scene in the first film is the part where they fight Medusa, where it's very quiet and she's sneaking up on him, you know. And it's like a Ray Harryhausen stop motion animated thing, so it's primitive in its way, but they have a lot of, like, personality.
It's genuinely a good scene in the original.
Yeah.
The original doesn't have it has an odd charm to it. I don't think I wouldn't qualify it as a good movie, but that scene is good.
Yeah. And this one, it's like Medusa's like this typical kind of CGI thing where she seems too weightless and she moves too fast and you just don't really believe in her, you know. And she looks like she's kind of pretty in the face, you know, but looks kind of like a fake face. You know, so.
Well, and it's weird because, you know, I always think about a character like Medusa in a set piece like that in the sense of, like, if you're developing like a strategy game or something. You know, if you're developing like a strategy game, all the different forces have to have balance. Everything, that, you know, each one needs to have a significant strength and a significant weakness, and there's got to be something that, you know, and that's a character thing too. You know, everybody should have a strength. They should have weaknesses, things that they can do really well and things that hobble them. And Medusa doesn't have that. Mm-hmm. You know, she's, like you say, okay, so yeah, she can turn anything she sees to stone. That's her significant strength. Mm-hmm. That's a pretty huge power. Mm-hmm. But then, like you say, she's also incredibly fast. She's a really good archer.
Yeah.
You know, she's massively strong. She know, you know, all of these things, and yet so she's not interesting. You know, you kind of watch her and she's just flipping around because you know that she's going to be defeated.
Yeah.
So it doesn't matter that she has all of these strengths.
Her head's off right there on the poster.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. It's like you know that she dies, so you have to do something to make her interesting, and just making her super powerful doesn't do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Maybe we should talk about the 3D in this particular movie.
Do we have to? Because there isn't really any.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, we were wondering if they knew how bad the movie was a few months ago and decided, like, well, let's convert it to 3D, and that might help us recoup our investment. You know, because it's not like y'all didn't like the 3D in the Alice in Wonderland movie as much as me, but
right.
This is like, but that at least had like went to the effort of having like stuff flying
and
in
it was
face,
intended to be 3D. They always intended it. I mean, at Comic-Con, they in 2009 they showed the trailer in 3D.
Right.
Clash was – the decision to make it 3D was made 2 months ago. Mm. They saw – they said, let's try to upconvert it. Warner saw a print. They liked it and, supposedly, and they're like, let's do it. Let's do that and just push the film back a week to upconvert it. And it's a scam. If you go to see this movie in 3D, you've been scammed out of your money, because if you see it in 3D – take off your glasses for a little bit and you'll see, oh, this just looks like a kind of blurry projection. It almost looks exactly the same. And when there are noticeable moments of 3D, the 3D looks really bad. Kurt, you want to give some,
examples? One example, I mean, they'll have things like a coin flipping out across the river Styx.
That's
miserable,
yeah.
And at least it's coming towards the audience, so it's in 3D. But they're like, well, you can tell that like they're bringing things so they look like they're coming forward more than other things. And the weirdest example is like Ray Fiennes, it's like his brow is sticking out and his hairline is further back.
Yeah.
So it's like I'm sure Ray Fiennes wasn't crazy about that, you know? And like, there's parts where there's a part where Perseus is like walking in with a group of people into Argo, and it's like Sam Worthington is not in the shot with the other people, and they dropped him in, which is I doubt seriously what happened, but it's, so it makes him look like a bad special effect almost, you know.
Well, there's in some of the scenes with Pegasus, the wings look super blurry and awful as they were trying to make those stand out, and I mean it's bad and. And like Matt said, as far as it being a scam, it's kind of true because especially after last week when three of the major theater chains raised 3D ticket prices 20 to 25% in some markets, you know, it's I don't know how the prices have changed in Atlanta, but I know that in a bunch of markets they went up, you know, $2 to $3 per 3D showing. So like in Seattle, a show that was $13.50 is now $16.50. In New York, a show that was $16.50 is now $19.50. You know, I mean, it's like they really, really jacked the prices. And this was this isn't studios. This is exhibitors jacking the prices because of the performance of Avatar and Alice in Wonderland. Mm-hmm. So out of nowhere, depending on where you live, you could potentially be paying a lot more to see Clash of the Titans now in 3D. And the 3D sucks.
Yeah.
It's completely crap. It's superfluous. Mm-hmm. It's a last minute, super glaringly obvious gloss on the movie that doesn't – it not only does it add nothing, it actively detracts from a movie that – doesn't really have that much to give in the first place.
Yeah. I mean, I've been saying, like, you might not – I'm not encouraging people to see it, but if they do see it, don't see it in 3D. You know, go to one of the 2D screens if that's a choice.
Save some money.
Yeah. Right, yeah. Right.
But
or better yet, go see How to Train Your Dragon.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about
thank
good 3D.
Thank you for segueing to the movie that you didn't actually see, Russ. Yeah. Matt and I saw this both at the Mall of Georgia IMAX in 3D, and it was one of the – best-looking 3D IMAX films I've seen ever. I mean, I didn't see Avatar in IMAX. You know, I saw Monsters vs. Aliens in 3D IMAX, and it was fine. But this just looked great. And this is like, I'm going to be like the stating the obvious guy, but like movies in IMAX can be like better and cooler than they would be without it, you know?
Right. So, I would say the only other movie I've seen in IMAX 3D was Avatar.
Mm-hmm.
As the second time I saw it, I figured I'd give it a chance in its ideal environment. And I sort of came to the conclusion, yeah, it's spectacle, but the story just isn't very good.
Did you not see the Toy Story re-releases?
I did,
IMAX?
But I didn't. I saw them in 3D, but I didn't see the screening wasn't in IMAX.
Gotcha.
But How to Train Your Dragon looks amazing, and I, especially with the flying sequences, comparing the two,
comparing Avatar's
flying sequences to
How to Train Your
Dragon. Thank you. what it just looks so much better. And I think part of that just comes down to directing. Mm-hmm. And what the directors of How to Train Your Dragon, they just knew how to shoot it better and cut it together better. But I would say just on the whole, it's just a better 3D movie. Mm-hmm. And I would say that even though ticket prices have gone up, mm-hmm. it's definitely a movie worth seeing in IMAX 3D because it's put together so well.
Yeah. Well, to sum up the plot of this quickly, it's about a young kind of wimpy Viking kid named Hiccup who's in this community where they're besieged by dragons. And he shoots down a dragon and injures it and sort of – whereas his family is like – and his fellow Vikings are very hostile, he sort of becomes friends with them and is kind of a dragon whisperer. You know, and creates, you know, so the humans and the dragons, you know, start to get along, and he kind of advocates for that. And there's a part where his, like, scenes with the dragon, they don't have a lot of dialogue, and the dragon's got an injured, like, tail feather.
Well, the dragon can't talk.
Yeah, well, obviously, yeah. And the dragon's got the injured tail feathers, or tail fin, I guess. And so there's a part where he's, like, teaching the dragon how to fly again and figuring out how to help the dragon fly again and, like, making plans. And so it reminded me
a lot. He's creating sort of a prosthetic.
Yeah, exactly. So he makes like a saddle and a way to help control it so he can fly on it. And it reminded me a bit of the films of the Japanese animator Hayao Miyazaki, who did Spirited Away and Porco Rosso and Princess Mononoke, because he has lots of scenes of like aerodynamics and flight and just sort of showing kind of the processy parts of it, you know. So it's like just sort of it communicates all this stuff in action so well, you know, and it's from DreamWorks Animation, which is the Shrek films, you know, which are usually just, you know, pop references and body function jokes and celebrity voices.
Well, yeah, I mean, DreamWorks Animation, which also include Monsters vs. Aliens, the DreamWorks animated movies are really often seen as these kind of inferior product to Pixar's movies, where you can take it's not like there's a one-to-one analog or anything like that, but basically if it's a piece of CGI animation with a DreamWorks stamp on it, pretty quickly it's kind of like, oh, okay, this is going to be a more lowbrow, less interesting, kind of more overtly kiddie sort of movie, which isn't necessarily a bad thing. I mean, if it's still a good movie, that's great. But, you know, DreamWorks has really developed this reputation for kind of being too invasive during the development of movies, having a bunch of screenwriters tackle the project over and over, but not really polish it to the state that Pixar does. It just ends up being kind of bland and muddy instead. And this movie seems to really stand out.
Well, it's interesting that you bring up sort of the DreamWorks attitude, because this past weekend I was watching the Toy Story Blu-ray, which came out last week, and there's this special feature on there called the Black Friday Cut. This is when Jeffrey Katzenberg, who runs DreamWorks Animation, he was still at Disney. And Pixar had put together this sort of storyboard of Toy Story. And Katzenberg's note was more cynical, edgier, more attitude. And to me, first off, I find it astounding anyone would be like more cynical. like that would be a good thing. And so, you know, John Lasseter, you know, reluctantly cuts this together from these storyboards, and he's like, this is the most miserable thing. Woody is just flat out mean. And the scene they show is when Woody knocks Buzz out the window. In the original cut, he's not meaning to do it. He's just sort of hoping he kind of falls behind the desk so he can go to Pizza Planet. And Buzz just falls out the window by accident. In the Black Friday version, because they showed it on this Friday, and it was just the worst cut, they hated it. Woody intentionally pushes Buzz out the window, and it's so that Buzz gets off his spot on the bed, and then when the other toys confront Woody about it, he's like, get off my bed and get out of my face, and like, it's awful. It's so mean-spirited, and to me, and then I just kept thinking back, wow, this is kind of like Shrek. Yeah. Like, Shrek isn't, like, totally mean, but, you know, it's an ogre who doesn't want anything to do with people. Yeah. And I'm sure, like, you know, eventually in the Toy Story cut, like, you know, Woody learns acceptance and things like that. But the fact that there would be this moment where you actively hate that character is just so wrong. And that's where Katzenberg wanted to steer it. Makes me kind of surprised that that How to Train Your Dragon, which is such a sweet movie, it's you know, it's kind of a boy and his dog movie, except it's a boy and his dragon, and it's just such a sweet movie, and I'm just so surprised it came from that studio, and I think it's by far their best film.
Well, it's I think it's of a piece with Kung Fu Panda, which is
better than most.
Yeah, yeah, and it's
better than most of the DreamWorks movies.
Yeah, and it's you know, works as kind of this, you know, comedy action film, you know, that's not quite as, you know, referential, and like the fighting is cool and exciting and stuff like that. So, and like How to Train Your Dragon is probably even less humor oriented than the others. And some of the jokes, like I don't want to oversell the movie because I think it's not as good as like a Pixar film, but
it's almost there.
Yeah, yeah.
I would say it's better than Cars.
Well, I will concede that point. Yeah. So.
But anyway, you were saying about the jokes and the
humor. Yeah, yeah. There's like little running bits of humor where it's like that probably should have either brought up a little more, so it would have been maybe a little bit more articulate, or just pushed back a little further, because otherwise, you know, it's like it's not that important to the movie, you know.
Right.
One thing that it's not doing that well, relatively speaking, which I wonder if it's part of like the this limited screen type things, because with Alice doing that, or
yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
Or maybe it's a repercussion of sort of the ticket price hike. Mm-hmm. People can't just keep going to see 3D movies. It's expensive. We're in a recession. People, you know, don't have jobs. And while movies are certainly cheaper than a vacation, which people have obviously – most people have had to forego at this point, you can't just keep going to see Alice in Wonderland and then How to Train Your Dragon and then Clash of the Titans.
I don't even have money for my staycation anymore.
Exactly. I've run out of staycation money. Yeah. And I hate – that is the worst idea. I'm sorry. And so and the thing is, this isn't about critical reception. How to Train Your Dragon is huge on Rotten Tomatoes. I think a lot of critics like it a lot.
Yeah,
so the critical support is there. I think if more people saw it, the word of mouth will be there. I hope it has a better weekend this weekend. But the problem again is
it's going to be against Clash of the Titans.
It's going to be against Clash of the Titans, and it's a number of screens. Mm-hmm. And I will say that How to Train Your Dragon, even though you should definitely see it in 3D, if you see it in 2D, it's still a good movie. Mm-hmm. And that's the most important thing. You can make your movie 3D. Sometimes you shouldn't with Clash of the Titans, but that film was beyond saving anyway. You need a good movie in the first place before you think, now we do it 3D.
Yeah.
And I'm really now sort of getting nervous because Warner Brothers is now saying, we need to make all our, you know, big budget movies 3D. So you're going to see the new Harry Potter film in 3D. Mm-hmm. And I was a little bummed because I had heard the 3D was bad, and the only screening we had was in 3D. We didn't have a choice. Mm-hmm. And
of Clash of the Titans.
For Clash of the Titans. And so I'm hoping in the future, at least, if it's these up-converted films, stuff that wasn't filmed in 3D, that I get the option to see it in 2D if I hear the 3D is bad, because that's a likely possibility with this up conversion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, one thing about How to Train Your Dragon is that it speaks to this kind of little issue regarding like animated films and family films, is that there seems to be a perception that like only kind of like so-called like boy-oriented films are the ones that people want to see, and this one, since it's like, you know, got, you know, dragons and fighting and all that, it seems, and it's a computer animated one and not a traditional hand-drawn one, it's supposed to be the kind that people want to see now. And the contrast with that is The Princess and the Frog, which made like about $100 million domestically, but it's considered to be a disappointment, and is used as an example for Disney taking their Rapunzel movie and changing its name to Tangled, and sort of apparently they're going to be trying to pitch it that it's not just like a Disney princess movie, but it's more of a boy.
Right.
But it's a popular for boys and male audiences too.
Yeah. True. Yeah. Although I would say Enchanted did very well. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I don't think most boys are like Enchanted.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so I don't know what happened with Princess and the Frog. I definitely do think that boys are turned away from a movie with princess in the title. Mm-hmm. But it is interesting that sort of the way kids' movies are developed and how they have to appeal to different audiences. Mm-hmm. And sort of, I guess, the fact that you name it Tangled rather than keep it as Rapunzel. Mm-hmm. is interesting because I remember, you know, I grew up with The Little Mermaid and Beauty and the Beast, and I love those films. I have no problem seeing a film called The Little Mermaid.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So I don't know what's changed over time, or if Princess and the Frog was just a case of maybe it wasn't marketed very well.
I think it was. I think Princess and the Frog was marketed poorly. I don't think that the ads and the trailers really conveyed what the movie was about, and I had no interest in seeing it. And, you know, I've liked some of the, you know, I liked The Little Mermaid. I saw it when it was out when I was, whatever, high school or something, and enjoyed it quite a lot. It was a fun movie. And you know, I'm not a huge Disney fan, but I see their stuff, and I end up liking a lot of those films. And Princess of the Frog, I only saw when I got it on Blu-ray and was really impressed. I mean, it's a great, really charming, funny, really well-made little movie, and it's a much better movie than would be indicated by the business that it did. Mm-hmm. But then again, Transformers 2 did outstanding business, and so did Alice in Wonderland, and those movies both suck. So,
consider the disclaimer made.
Exactly. But the thing is, I think that people didn't get what Princess and the Frog was really about. They didn't really get what movie it was. They had maybe, based on the title, a preconception that isn't what the movie actually is. And it's unfortunate because it really is an excellent little film.
Yeah, it's probably because it's this charming musical comedy that's steeped in New Orleans and the music of New Orleans and the cultures and things like that, and kind of doing this little balancing act of, you know, involving race in New Orleans and having this sort of strong, positive African-American princess character because there had not yet been an African-American princess character. So I almost think that, like, that's a lot of baggage for it to have, and still people who kind of didn't necessarily want to see, like, this musical romance with all this culture stuff, you know, maybe a little bit more ass-kicking or something like that might have brought people in more, you know. Or maybe it should have been pitched to adults more, you know.
Maybe. There isn't a lot of ass-kicking, but there are some great sequences with this sort of antagonistic...
the Baron Samedi character.
Yeah, voodoo sort of character.
And Mr. Facilier, I think they called
it. I think so. And they're really gorgeously animated, and they're set to, you know, they have some of the better songs that are in the film, or certainly the more... Not necessarily the better songs, but some of the more kind of aggressively dynamic songs. Mm-hmm. So pulse-pumping music as opposed to some of the slightly more laid-back stuff that's in the film. And those sequences are incredible. I mean, the animation is phenomenal, and those sequences really do call back to these classic days of Disney and hand animation in a way that very few other films manage to do.
Right.
And I mean, it's worth seeing for those sequences alone. And then the rest of the movie is great. The performances are fantastic. It's a good little movie.
Okay. Right. And I'm hopeful that even though it didn't do the business I think it should have done, or maybe that Disney wanted it to do, because John Lasseter, who's the head of Pixar, also was brought on to run Disney Animation Studios, which hadn't made a 2D film since Treasure Planet.
Or vlogged. Either that, or maybe I think Home on the Range might have been the last one.
Oh, Home on the Range was the last one.
Yeah, it was, yeah.
Exactly, but that's the thing. And Lasseter's like, no, there's a great tradition here, and we're going to do it. And one of the things I really like about Princess and the Frog is it is hand-drawn, but it brings in sort of computer animation in the sense of how they're able to incorporate different styles of animation rather than sort of you had to sort of do the cell hand-drawn process for the movie, the Disney movies of the early 90s. And actually, it's funny that we're talking about this because there's a documentary that's come out called Waking Sleeping Beauty, which is sort of about the revival of Disney Animation Studios. And it hasn't come out here in Atlanta yet, but I've heard great things about it. And I'm hoping that we get to catch it soon.
Cool. Well, should we do our picks for further viewing, basically?
Sure. Go ahead.
Okay, well, I thought I would... because talking about Clash of the Titans and the Greek movies, I would go back to what I think is the one that I like the most, which is the Jason and the Argonauts from the early 1960s. I don't remember the year exactly, but it's another one with Ray Harryhausen doing the stop-motion special effects. And there's the seven-headed Hydra, and there's like nine skeletons fighting them at the end, and a giant called Talos who's made out of metal and things like that. So, and it's kind of does the Greek men, you know, doing the battle, you know, on the behest of the gods thing. With it's cheesy, but it has a certain dignity to it that I think that the Clash movies don't.
I will mine. I guess if I really tried, I could loosely relate to Clash of the Titans, but I don't know that I'm going to bother trying to do that. I finally got to see a movie called Triangle not too long ago, which is this interesting little thriller, I guess you would call it, directed by a guy named Christopher Smith, who has previously made a couple of films, one called Creep that you probably haven't seen, and one called Severance, which you may have seen.
Saw Severance.
Severance
and
is good.
Severance is a lot of fun. You could call Severance kind of like The Office meets Hostel. It's a really entertaining film from a couple of years back. And so Chris Smith did this movie called Triangle, which is basically starts out with this guy, a couple of his friends, and this woman who's a waitress who he kind of knows and has been hitting on. And they all go out sailing. And while they're sailing, they're beset by this really large sort of freak storm that overturns their sailboat. And they're stranded. And this large ocean liner comes out of nowhere. And they're really psyched. They think they're saved, and they kind of hail it, and they get on the liner. And they're walking around, and there's nobody on the boat, or they can't find anybody on the boat. But it looks like there are people there. Like, they come into this banquet hall, and there's all this food set out and all this sort of thing. And then things start to get really, really weird. And there's this sense that maybe – at first, there's this sense that maybe they're being stalked by someone – but it's not – I almost hate to even mention that because it kind of sounds like this routine, like, you know, weird killer hunting people movie. And then it's not
You've
what
got us intrigued
is.
Already, so.
Yeah. It's like that's not what this is. It's a really kind of neat – it's a very small-scale movie. I mean, there's only a few people in it. And it's just a really nicely written, nicely constructed, well put together little thriller that'll have you kind of trying to untangle what's going on for most of it, and then once you get it, you'll be kind of like, oh, okay, yeah, that's cool, and it like calls back to the myth of Sisyphus, and it has maybe a little injection of the classic story and poem, The Rime of the Ancient Mariner.
Awesome.
And so there's a lot of stuff going on in it, and it's just a nice, tidy little. Tasty little movie. It's streaming on Netflix. It's on DVD. You could probably get it on demand. And it's short. It's an hour and a half. So real quick in and out, but really nicely built.
I don't have anything Clash or Greek gods related, but I actually recommended this film yesterday to a friend of mine. I let him borrow DVDs of mine. He looked at my shelf. And so he was looking for something. I had just lent him Big Trouble in Little China, which he really enjoyed. And anyway, so he was looking at the shelf, and I'm like, you should see Running Scared, because that's a movie that I really enjoy, and no one – it's a movie that when you
– You're talking about the Paul Walker.
Yes,
Paul Walker
exactly, because when you first bring it up, it's like, isn't that the movie with, you know
– you know, I mean, I enjoyed the Billy Crystal, Barry Hines movie when it came out, but
exactly,
that's not what you're referring to, though.
No, it isn't. It's a film – it's by the director of The Cooler, and his name escapes me at this moment. Can we
– Kramer? Something Kramer?
It is Kramer. It's, no, Can it's –
Peter Kramer?
Okay. Yeah, Russ is looking it up because his name escapes me at the moment. But – so you have this film with Paul Walker, who most people – I don't think Paul Walker's ever really done a good film other than this one. This film is insane. It's about Paul Walker – he's this criminal who's trying to track down a gun that was used in a murder. This kid has taken this gun, and he needs to go save the kid. But really, he's after the gun. And it leads them on this sort of weird sort of dystopian odyssey. It's almost – it's like an – the best way I can describe it, and it's really messed up, it's like an R-rated kids film in the sense that, like, it's a journey and a quest, and you go through all these really strange, twisted as fuck places. But in a weird way, it does sort of – the narrative resembles that kind of kid quest movie, because he's – the kid is going through all these places as well, and there's a lot of action. There's a scene – there's this climax where Paul Walker – he's been captured by these mob guys, and the way they choose to beat him up is to – kick the crap out of him on an ice skating rink that's being lit by blacklight.
Right.
So, so it also, in a weird way, and maybe this is just a random thought, but it recalls the Warriors, and sort of you have these just sort of larger than life criminal circumstances that you know, other criminals are falling into, but there are criminals that we're rooting for. And so Paul Walker's in it, gives a great performance. Vera Farmiga is in it as well. She wasn't very well known at the time, but she's also great in it. And so it's a film you may have avoided because of the title or because you don't like Paul Walker. But
he's the guy from the Fast and the Furious movies, who's not Vin Diesel.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. And so, but I would recommend giving it a shot and checking it out.
Yeah, the director of Running Scared is Wayne Kramer. Guess I would also compare it kind of to the Crank movies in the sense that it's got the same sort of anarchic spirit. And it's better than those. I don't like Running Scared as much as Matt does, but it's definitely entertaining and it's very singular. It's kind of its own sort of thing. And actually, I'll bat another one back based on that, and because we just had Akira Kurosawa's 100th birthday last week, one of his early movies called Stray Dog, in which Toshiro Mifune is a rookie cop who, during this incredibly hot summer, has his service pistol stolen, and so he kind of goes into these semi-underworld sort of subculture areas of town to try to recover his gun, and it's a great early Mifune movie, a great early Kurosawa movie, and just a solid picture in general. So jumping off from the stolen gun, missing gun aspect of Running Scared is Stray Dog, also Netflixable and in a available in a nice edition from the Criterion Collection.
Well, I won't let you get started on Akira Kurosawa, because then we'd be here all day, so in a good way, you know. But so I'll just wind it up by saying thanks for listening to Running Dialogue, and my name again is Kurt Holman, and I'm on Twitter at CURT_HOLMAN.
And I'm Matt Goldberg. I'm the managing editor for Collider.com, and you can follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/MattGoldberg, all one word.
And I'm Russ Fisher from SlashFilm.com, and on Twitter I am Russ Fisher, all one word.